the blue skies blue. Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be lost. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be lost. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live near Baba's lives. Mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more be used from men? Can't you stand?
Little more of Marvin Gaye. What's going on? And of course, the great Marvin Gaye, born on this day, and we'll be playing his music on many of our breaks in the course of the next hour and a half. We are here talking about an Annapolis roundup. It's almost time for the session to end. So our two regular State House reporters who join us a lot are on by phone because they're doing their job in Annapolis. We are joined by Brian Sears, government reporter for the Daily Record, and it's I on Annapolis blog, and Charles Robinson, who is a political commentator but also the State House reporter for Maryland Public Television. Marta Mossberg is in studio, visiting fellow at the Maryland Public Policy Institute and a nationally syndicated columnist, and Dr. John Bullock, professor of political science at Towson University and a political activist in our community who follows issues in Annapolis and beyond. Good to have the four of you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
And
good morning, Art.
Good to have you all here. 410-319-8888 is the number. What's the issue grabbing you the most you think we need to talk about? 410-319-8888. Join us here. And you can also write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Let me ask you all this, start with this way. One of the things that's kind of always gets me with the political machinations is the question of how we pay for things and how we fill holes in budgets. So Governor Martin O'Malley several years ago, I guess it was 3 years ago, made a deal with the Maryland State pensioners. And he told the Maryland pensioners, well, you know, we're going to have you pay more in your unfunded pension funds, and with new hires, we'll have to get lower pension benefits. We're going to put $100 million into this, and State promised $200 million annually from resulting savings to go into this to shore it up. So what's going on now is that Governor Martin O'Malley is going to grab back $100 million a year to plug a hole in the state deficit, which just doesn't answer the question either for the pensioners. We're talking about, you know, that have 138,000 retirees who with a $40 billion pension fund, $3 billion paid out. And it just seems like this goes under the radar, Charles Robinson. Nobody ever talks about it.
It's kind of like, you know, who do you want to tick off in your last couple of years in office? And in this case, he decided that retirees were the easiest thing he could do. And he's essentially said, I'm going to leave it to my predecessor to fix it. And, you know,
successor, right?
When you're in technically the lame duck term as governor, you know, you could piss off a few people here and there. Mm-hmm.
Brian?
Yeah, Mark, you know, it's interesting because the labor unions have the deal has kind of evolved a little bit. The legislature is looking at phasing in. The governor's plan originally proposed to take $100 million of this $300 million extra they were going to put into the pension system, and he wanted to take $100 million of it forever to put towards the budget. And the legislature has come back recognizing that the pension system is underfunded. It's about 65% funded. That's not great. And they now want to take essentially about $400 million in the first 15 months and start phasing that money back into the original 300 at roughly about $50 million a year. And then they want to keep that $300 million a year extra in pension payments going to the pension until they get the pension system up to about 85%. You know, but as we've seen in the last 3 years, you know, this deal was made in 2011. You know, all of these deals are subject to change, and so, you know, what the legislature does now, they can undo in a year or in 2 years, you know, if and when they decide that there's necessity.
You know, I'd love to chime in on this one. I mean, the big picture, I think, is the most important thing to look at. I mean, as Brian mentioned, the system is funded about 65%. It's one of the worst in the country, actually. It's in the bottom tier, which no one ever talks about and should a lot more, because this seriously impacts, you know, the long-term funding aspects. They want to get it up to 80, but beyond that, you know, the state of Maryland has not been good at investing the money it does have already in the system. And as a result, it's lost a lot of money, or it hasn't gained as much as it should over the past few years of the market going up. So that's been a significant problem. And there's been a lot of people have suggested that Maryland should change the way it invests money, because right now it has a bunch of very expensive money managers that are not performing as they should, and it's also invested in some very risky assets that are not performing as well as they should. So there's, you know, you could go to all index funds, for example, which would take out the fees and save a lot of money. There's been different people have done studies on that, but this is something that if it's not fixed, it's going to be a serious broken promise to the employees of Maryland.
And Mark, one of the things that we should note is under the original plan that the governor had proposed, taxpayers were looking at being on the hook, I think in 2025, to the tune of over, you know, $1.65 billion, if they had to, you know, if they had to backfill this pension system because of the reduction in these overpayments. And again, I want to make sure everybody understands, when we're talking about $300 million, we're not talking about money that the state is obligated to pay into the system. They are meeting what their statutory obligation is. This was an additional $300 that was part of this deal with unions, where they said, hey, look, if you agree to this stuff, we're going to save money. And some of that savings, $300 million of that savings, we're going to pay extra into the system, and they now want to take part of that back.
Right. But what's also so frustrating and so unfortunate is that it really is this common theme of sort of kicking the can down the road, right? These retirees, it'll be in the future, so we don't have to worry about it. You know, I have a stake in it as a state employee, as one who is an educator of the state system. I know I signed a contract, and you have expectation that your retirement is going to look a certain way. And we do know that it's at, what, 65%? Funded now, and there are numerous cases throughout the country of pensions not being funded, and then we just say, oh, well, tough luck, things are subject to change. And that's not really, it's not a fair way to go, but also it's not a sustainable way to go. So if we're talking about really smartly investing the money that's in the system, but really sticking to those agreements with the unions, AFSCME, you know, the Maryland State Education Association, again, these are deals that people are signing on to and are expecting to actually follow through.
So let me move on to another subject here. When we have our reporters, they may have to run at some point to kind of cover some things as what the last madness of the session going on. But one of the things that was really interesting about this session, because it couldn't happen last session, was the bill passing for rights for transgender people in Maryland. That caused some controversy. I mean, people who oppose bills like to change names of bills, like the stormwater runoff became the rain tax, and this has become the bathroom bill.
But, well, Common Core has now become the Maryland College Preparedness as well. So.
On the other side as well.
Right.
So let's talk a bit about this bill, because it did have some opposition, but really, for all the opposition, sailed through. What do we think this means? Well, Brian, let me start with you and go around the room. What's your analysis of what this meant?
You know, I mean, I think I'm not quite sure. I guess I'm not quite sure exactly what the point of your question is. But I think that this is a bill that had been hanging around in Annapolis for about the last decade. After same-sex marriage passed, it was really sort of seen as the next step towards the issue of civil rights. And I don't think that this is necessarily the bill passage and signing into law is a done deal. It's going to happen. The legislature's already passed it. And there's every expectation that the governor is going to sign this. There are some rumblings about whether or not there will be some groups that will attempt to take this to referendum. I have to be honest with you. You can probably put me in one of those camps where I'm skeptical of A, whether or not it will go to referendum, and B, if it does go to referendum, will it succeed? Because you've had a lot of other higher profile issues, including the DREAM Act and same-sex marriage, that went to referendum and just absolutely went nowhere. And I'm just not convinced that this is going to be something that's going to grab the imagination of Maryland voters and drive them to the polls to vote this down.
Well, I guess what I was trying to say was, this, I mean, it's called the Fairness for All Maryland's Act, Marylanders Act of 2014, that bans discrimination based on sexual orientation and sexual identity, excludes religious organizations, excludes private clubs and locker rooms, and certain parts of educational institutions. But this is pretty encompassing beyond that. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is I think it's a pretty profound bill to have passed our Senate in the way it passed.
I agree. What we're seeing now is that it's not really okay to discriminate against anyone right at this point. And I think it's really interesting. You mentioned the Fairness for All Marylanders Act versus the, quote, bathroom bill, right? And so what you have there is still some of that backlash against, you know, how people identify in terms of, you know, being transgender. But, you know, again, we're progressing, right? I mean, Maryland sometimes likes to look at itself as a progressive state. And again, the opportunity for all people to be treated equally, regardless of how they identify, is a really significant piece for this time in our state and this time in our country.
Yeah, a couple things. I don't think that it's particularly surprising that this passed in Maryland. I mean, once gay marriage passed, I just saw this as a sort of a natural progression. I mean, the state is very progressive. I don't find what Neil Parrott is doing and, you know, possibly suggesting a referendum. I don't think that's going to work, but I don't think that it's a joke, some of the arguments that he's raised. I mean, when someone talks about, when you're talking about someone who thinks that their sincere expression of whatever their sexual identity is or their gender, who's to judge that? I mean, I don't. If someone wants to, if someone thinks they're a woman or thinks they're a man, and I think there's a lot of room for people to take advantage of that under this bill, and that to me is an issue that isn't just a joke.
Is that Charles? Go ahead.
I think the proponents of this bill wanted to couch this as a discrimination issue. I think those opponents wanted to, I don't want to say ridicule the idea of, you know, putting different signs on the doors of bathrooms. But, you know, we saw that in the years past where, you know, some legislators would mockingly talk about, well, what sign do you put on the door of the bathroom? What's it going to be like if a transgender person happens to stand next to you in a stall? And I think all those arguments went away after, you know, the same-sex marriage bill went forward. But the other thing is that Maryland has become this incubator, if you will, for the idea of what is that next step in the whole idea of how we identify ourselves, either be it gay, transgender, or whatever. And this petri dish, if you will, has become the I don't want to call it the calling card for LGBT issues, but you see that across the state. I see more people feeling comfortable with just the idea. Well, look, these are people, quote, doing their thing. And who am I to stand in the way of that?
Someone just chatted in, trans people probably have been in the bathroom with all of you, and you didn't even know it.
Of course, I mean, you look at where the nation is going in a lot of ways. There's colleges right now that have co-ed bathrooms. So it's our society has changed dramatically, and social conservatives, I think, very much in Maryland, are on the losing side of this, and for better or worse.
Right. I know here I am, at Towson, we have some gender-neutral bathrooms, and that's important to have. But I think it's also important.
Men, women, and gender-neutral.
Yeah. And I think what's also interesting is that there's this perception, right, that trans people are somehow predators who are now going to dress a certain way and are going to follow somebody into the bathroom and do something untoward, which is generally not the case. But also we have to think about, this is beyond bathrooms. We're talking about jobs, homes, public accommodations.
That's true.
And so this is a broad array of areas that we're talking about.
That's the really important point to make, and I think a lot of colleges have gone there. UMBC has also designated gender-neutral bathrooms along with men's and women's rooms. But Brian Sears, this is a political question about the attitude in Annapolis, because, I mean, yeah, Maryland is a progressive political state, especially on some social and economic issues, without doubt. But this particular issue is one that I bet you a dollar to a donut that most legislators have no idea what it's really about. There's their whole a notion of what transgender mean, not even knowing transgender people, why this bill was kind of how it was important to some. So I'm curious what this scuttlebutt is. Well, what are legislators saying about it?
I mean, look, I don't think that the attitude of legislators is on this issue is that dissimilar to that of the general public. I mean, I one of the numbers that we heard floated around down here, Mark, was that there were roughly about 30,000 trans people identify as transgender people in Maryland. So I think for a lot of folks who, you know, that's not part of their everyday life and their everyday experience, it's probably something that's a little difficult to sort of wrap your head around. So the issue for them really boiled down to the issue of discrimination and equality. And I think that what you saw was proponents of the bill this year who did a really good job of explaining to their colleagues why they felt like this change was needed. And we're able to do it in a way that they hadn't been able to do in years past because, again, this bill had been floating around in various forms for about a decade.
Folks, what are your thoughts out there? 410-319-8888. Let's get some calls in here, your ideas. You can chat me. You can jump up and join us on Facebook. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. Write us an email at steinershow@gmail.com. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Loudy, you're on the air.
Good morning. It's Ludi from Pikesville. How are you guys
Ludi,
doing?
Ludi, I'm sorry. Very well.
No problem. The topic that I'm bringing up is not particularly about what you guys were talking about. I just wanted to bring up a topic that I haven't heard in the news, so I wanted to know if that was okay.
Well, we're actually focusing on what's happening in Annapolis, but
Okay. Well, the topic was about the DuPont heir, Robert Richards. I don't know, from Dover, Delaware. I don't know if you've heard about his... He committed rape to his 3-year-old daughter, but was spared jail because they said he wouldn't fare well in prison. So I wanted to talk about the disparity of the rich and the poor and how money can buy your way out of being locked up for a crime that if you were poor, you would have been locked up for. So maybe another show.
Yeah, we can. There's a subject I'll bring up now that can maybe touch a bit of that. And I think as people jokingly call what happened to DuPont and others, affluenza.
Well, the Texas case, that was the one that, made headlines, the idea bigger headlines, I think.
That you can't survive in prison because you're rich, well, it's too bad. Right. But clearly that happened there. We can talk about that. We've talked about disparity in sentencing a lot on this program over the years, and so we'll come back to that. And I do appreciate you calling in and raising the issue at 410-319-8888. But it does bring to mind another issue that was that has really been we've talked about a lot on this show for many, many years, which was lawyers at bail. We have the Maryland's highest court made a ruling that people have a right to an attorney at their first bail hearing, not later, but at that moment, at sentencing and all the rest. They have a right to a lawyer, and it was clear when we had the Annapolis summit that the president of the Senate didn't agree with it, so he was going to ignore what the highest court said you had to do. Now, that would be like, let's say, liberals and progressives and in the United States Congress saying, well, no matter what the Supreme Court said, if we disagree with the Voting Rights Act, we're going to do it anyway because we don't agree with what you said.
Or perhaps selective enforcement of Obamacare.
Well, I don't think that quite fits it, but I do think the other one does. But this is interesting that here you have these folks in the legislature are going to say we're going to figure out ways to get around a court ruling. What are our thoughts on this?
Mark, I've been covering this particular issue.
Charles Robinson.
I know Brian has too. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting was the fact they knew where they were going to, if they were to follow the rules of the court, they would have had to hire hundreds of public defenders for indigent folk who didn't have lawyers. And they tried to figure out a way to get around that, and they came up with this thing called the Arnold system, which is essentially a computer program that would make a determination based on your prior history, if you've ever been arrested for assault or various other crimes, and make a determination of whether or not you stay in jail or you get bail. As Senator Zirkin has said, it's the biggest travesty he's ever seen. You're going to take a human element out of the court proceeding
and leave it to basically a computer program to figure out
right.
who stays in jail and who let who lets go. And that's kind of the, if you will, the underlying thing that's going on, because we have a lot of defense attorneys down in Annapolis who are concerned that their clients are going to pick up on the raw end of every deal with this computer program. Mm-hmm.
And Brian, you were about to say what?
Hey, let's get down to brass tacks here a little bit, Mark. I mean, we are literally, what, 5 days away from the end of session, and I will tell you right now that the General Assembly, there is no consensus on how to handle this issue. The Senate passed out a bill that, you know, that nobody's even really sure that that in the end the Court of Appeals is going to accept, and it can't be fully implemented until next May, which is probably going to require the court system to continue to stay their decision. In the meantime, you've got factions over in the House, including Joe Valerio, who really don't agree with the court decision, think they got it wrong. There's the real possibility that this could turn into what we've seen happen with the Pitbull bill over the last couple of years, where we could adjourn sine die on Monday, walking out of here with no resolution, which could ultimately lead the Court of Appeals to impose their ruling and their plan, which, depending on which numbers you believe, could run the taxpayers anywhere in the neighborhood of $30 to $55 million. Although I will tell you that I had one legislator raise a question with me last night questioning that amount. The public defenders deal with about 150 to 170,000 cases a year, and if you figure they have panelist attorneys that work for them at about $50 an hour. I did the math last night. That comes up to substantially less than $30 million a year.
Uh-huh.
So there's the possibility that maybe this could be done cheaper. But I got to tell you, at this point there doesn't seem to be any consensus. A lot of discussion happening on this issue. The governor's office has been involved. They had a meeting behind closed doors of a work group looking at this issue. But I don't get the sense that there's any real consensus. And I will tell you, there are a number of legislators in both chambers who are telling me they think there's a real possibility that we're going to walk out of here without having done anything, and the distinct possibility that the legislature might need to come back into a special session to deal with it. Otherwise, you know, they could be looking at a fairly large bill at the end of the year.
That's really interesting.
Right.
Commentators in the studio.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure where this legislation goes, but it's very interesting, you know, how the caller made this segue, because really what we're talking about is also inherent in this are going to be disparities as it relates to wealth, right? So we're talking about indigent defendants, right, and those who aren't able to afford a lawyer versus someone who may be well connected and who may have committed a heinous crime but has no criminal record, and can have a defense attorney argue that, oh, my client will show up to court, there are no prior offenses, versus someone who's indigent who may likely have a history of petty crimes, things that may not actually be violent or may not even be a threat to society. But if you put it into a statistical system, it may not take into account all of the human factors that are involved. So more than likely, it's going to have a disparate effect on those who lack resources.
You know, this is an issue because of the money, nothing else. You know, I don't think that the Senate president or the administration would be against anything like this if they had money, but they don't. O'Malley is taking money from every single special dedicated fund to put it into the general fund, issuing bonds to pay for the things that were supposed to be paid for in cash, and now we have structural deficits. So, we're constantly in a situation where anything comes up and we can't afford to deal with it. So you selectively not enforce the law. It's not a good way to govern.
So, and Mark, I've had attorneys who have said to me that what they think the legislature and the governor ought to do is, rather than try to figure out a way to get around this court decision, is in the end just pony up the money and pay for the attorneys to be present because it's the right thing to do. But right now the legislature really seems intent on trying to find a way to mitigate the court decision.
So it does feel like that. I mean, it does seem like that, clearly. And the question is, you mentioned something, Brian, like you and Charles had talked about just for a second. What are the chances, how could this particular issue force a special session?
It's the last thing that people want. Remind yourself, this is an election year. These people want to get out of here and start campaigning. We got the short window for a primary, and no one's happy.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Charles is exactly right. Nobody wants to do a special session in an election year. But if you're asking me how I think it could force a special session,
yeah.
I think all you have to do is look at a price tag of $55 billion or more. I mean, we've heard higher numbers than $55 million. And once you start to look at those numbers in budget years that are really tight, local governments that are strapped, and you know, and the state government that's trying to find, you know, is pulling as Martha's pulling money out of every single state to pay its bills. You know, $55 million is a pretty big check to write, and so I think that there's going to be a lot of effort to try and find a way to mitigate that.
I think we should open up another casino or just legalize pot and dedicate all the funds to pay for this.
Actually, I actually agree with that. I mean, there's something to be said about taxing and legalizing marijuana. Other states have actually cut down their budget deficits by doing so. So, I mean, that's...
I'm making a joke because Maryland doesn't have a way to make money other than casinos, and I don't know, who knows, maybe we'll legalize prostitution. It just seems like that's our money generator right now, tax revenue generator, and it doesn't speak well for our economy.
Our economy is a big part of the American economy, period, or the world economy in general. Mm-hmm. But we have to take a break here in a couple minutes. I wanted to check in with Brian and Charles. Can you guys stay? Do you have to run and cover something?
I can stay for a few more minutes.
All right. So, because you know, I am curious to kind of cover a little bit on this issue before we move to our next issue. Just how this has been handled by also the Senate and the House. I mean, they seem to be really, in some ways, in a real panic over this issue, as Brian was describing pretty aptly, and Charles was describing pretty aptly. I mean, you know, you've got Democratic leadership like Mike Miller and Joe Valerio, who are both private criminal attorneys, who really oppose pretrial reform. They always have, and you know, before and after the Richmond decision. And whether or not that's a conflict of interest, I mean, almost everybody in there is a lawyer. So
everyone pretty much is a lawyer. There's huge conflicts of interest all over the place on that panel.
And you have the bail bondsmen who have a huge lobbying group, mm-hmm. and were allowed to testify before the Judiciary Committee in private, so they really couldn't be challenged or questioned. So, I mean, I'm a bit curious about the politics of this and how you view that. We're going to take a very brief break and come back and tackle that subject before we hit the other areas that are happening in Annapolis, and also hear what our guests think was really accomplished in this session. Was it a great session? Mediocre? Miserable. Stay with us.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way.
Now, when I was a little boy, at the age of 5, I had something in my pocket. Keep a lot of folks alive.
Bo Diddley, 1955. This was on the LP that exploded Bo Diddley onto the scene. And so on this day in 1955, so we'll play a little Bo Diddley today, too. Let's get right into this. Before, let me just say, as we get into this, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com, or go to steinershow.org and click on MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We are joined here by Dr. John Bullock from Towson State University, political science professor, Marta Mossberg, visiting fellow at the Maryland Public Policy Institute, Brian Sears, government reporter for the Daily Record and its Ion Annapolis blog, Charles Robinson, who is the State House reporter for Maryland Public Television, and you at 410-319-8888. Come to these calls in just a second. But let me jump right back to where we were. And I know, Brian and Charles, you may have to jump ship in a second. But so let me go to you first, Charles, and then Brian, just about this whole idea of the power of the bail bond industry. This is not talked about very much in this. Their secret session. What does all that mean to you, Charles, and then Brian?
They are the ones that kind of like, whatever you do, don't take us out. I'm talking about the bail bonds. Don't take us out of the system. And so they're pretty much assured that they're going to be a part of the system, whatever the outcome is. I think you asked about the politics of this. It's about the devil you know or the devil you don't know. In other words, if they don't come up with a deal, the courts will impose a settlement. And I don't know if that's going to be to the good of the legislature and government, and I think that's what's really frightening a lot of folks. Conversely, you know, if they come up with a short-term fix, will the courts be satisfied with that? The court was pretty clear. Yes, defendants can be represented. One of the things I know they're going to have to do is they're going to have to get rid of what are called the court commissioners. These are the folks who sit and read the charges and tell you whether or not you should get bond or not. They're pretty much out of the loop. After that, it's pretty much a wild card.
But Brian, maybe you had this picture on the Daily Record website. I think it was, if I remember correctly, and on the Daily Record, of the closed meeting sign.
Yes.
Right. And so I'm going back to Bill Bosman for a moment. I mean, you know, they didn't testify before the Judiciary Committee, but they did testify privately in front of this 9-person group they legislated with, included Valerio. So, I mean, what can you give a sense of what you think is really going on here?
I mean, look, I think that in some respects Charles is exactly right. I mean, I think that the bail bondsmen want to – there had been some discussion about the idea of getting rid of the bail system altogether. There was a discussion in December by this legislative task force looking at this issue. And one of the things that they looked at was the possibility of going to a system where, you know, you don't have a bail system anymore. You either have people who get out on their own recognizance, people who get out under some kind of a condition where they have to go to drug treatment or there's some kind of monitoring by a state agency, and then people who are never getting out until trial. And I think they, you know, the bail bonds industry took a look at that and wanted to make sure that they were still involved. You know, but look, I don't know that they're necessarily any more influential than, say, the trial lawyers or any of the other groups. I think that they wanted to make sure that they had their. I don't think that the bail bond system is going to go away. And I'll disagree respectfully with Charles on one other thing. I don't think that the court commissioners are going to go away in their entirety. I think that their job description is going to change. There's a real likelihood that they're not going to be doing initial bail hearings. What the ultimate system turns out to be is anybody's guess. But there are a lot of legislators here who still see a real benefit in having the court commissioners. They do a lot of the domestic violence cases and some of those initial things that are related to DV cases. And I think that there's a sense that they want to keep them around for that. Plus, you know, nobody wants to have judges, especially the judges, nobody wants to have judges working nights and weekends. So I don't think that you're going to see this extinction of court commissioners. But their job description is probably going to change, and I imagine that that's going to be something that evolves fairly quickly over the next couple of years.
Charles, I know you have to run. I just got the note about that. So, Charles Robinson, a State House reporter for MPT, thanks for being with us. Look forward to talking
You're
to you
welcome.
Soon.
Take care.
Folks in the studio, Marta?
I'm just going to defer to Brian on this one. I mean, this is not something I've focused on a lot with my work. I focus mostly on economic issues. So this is I've read about this, but I'm mostly interested in finding out why the bail industry is so profitable, as we were talking about off air. So.
Yeah, but that's an investigative piece people have been doing for years and years and years.
You know, one thing I'll say, and I guess it's tied to that industry, but really thinking about, you know, the defense lawyers who have an objection, to this process. And it's very interesting if you put them in perspective and say, well, how about you not show up to your defendant's bail hearing and see how that works out, right? But again, there are those who have the resources to have private attorneys that do well. But again, people have a right to public defenders, and it's something that the court has passed, and it's something that that should still be upheld.
So during the break, we heard Beverly Burke's headlines for the news, and one of the things she talked about was the continuing debate over tax credits for the film industry in the state of Maryland, which has gotten a lot of press, and there's been a lot of push back and forth in this. And to me, there's an interesting juxtaposition between that and the battle for minimum wage, which we'll jump to after that. But what about this? Because we see, you know, this question of whether it's a question of losing jobs, or are we just feeding the coffers of a multi-billion-dollar industry who threatened to leave Maryland and not continue shooting the films that are shot here.
this is, I mean, it's just a very incoherent economic policy that the state practices, because it goes at, you know, it goes after these tax credit, or it gives grants tax credits to certain industries. It likes to pick winners, biotech, for example, green energy, the film credits, big, you know, there's a handful of developers in Baltimore, for example, that get all the tax credits. But what about the rest of the people out there who own businesses that aren't so, that aren't sexy, like House of, you know, aren't developing House of Cards or some other, you know, well-watched video or movie? I don't think that's a way to run a state government. I think you need to have policies that are consistent for everyone and fair for everyone, and not just those who are well-connected.
I mean, some of that criticism is legitimate, but there's something else to this discussion. Again, you're talking about industries. We're talking about the film industry, right? That gets tax credits more than, if you get more than $10 million in tax credits, that if you leave the state, then Maryland's able to seize your property. And there's a longer history that this goes back to, and it's interesting, not funny, but we just celebrated, 30 years since the Colts left. And that was something, the reason why they left under the cover of night, because, again, it was something that Schaefer was thinking about doing in terms of using eminent domain to keep the Colts. And so if you think about the identity of the state and having something like House of Cards that being produced here, again, there is that impetus to keep something like that in the state. Now, we can agree that it may not produce tons of jobs, and again, to some degree, there is you know, picking of winners and losers, or the industries you know, that you like. But again, there is that silver lining in that you know, in that bill that at least allows, or at least, you know, sort of puts a little pressure on those industries that are receiving tax credits to remain in the state.
You just never know that that's going to happen, though. I mean, I worked as a reporter in North Carolina before I came up to Maryland, and one of the big stories I covered was Dell moving into Winston-Salem, and they opened this huge plant. It was a PC plant. They got $300 million, and then the plant proceeded to close a year later after people were driving an hour from Virginia to come work at this place. And I don't know if they recoup the money or not. I mean, if something goes bankrupt, the company doesn't have the money to pay it back.
So, Brian, come in and talk a bit about where this is going, because we've seen people like there's a delegate Frick who wanted to seize the property. So where is all this?
Yeah, I mean, and there's a couple of things I wanted to talk about here.
Please, Mark, go ahead.
The first thing is that it's not just about seizing the property. Part of this amendment actually talks about seizing the intellectual property, where Maryland theoretically could own the rights to House of Cards. Look, let me tell you, I don't think that that's going to happen. Right now, this language survives in conference committee. They put it on hold, the discussions on hold with it again yesterday. But Senator Ed Casemeyer told me pretty clearly that he's not happy with this language. He doesn't think that this language is going to survive. And one of the things he's concerned about is not just about the message that this sends to House of Cards, but this idea that the state could seize your intellectual property. He says it sends a really bad message, not to just the filmmakers that they're trying to entice to come to Maryland, but to the people like researchers who want to come to Maryland and do work and get state grants and tax credits. And is this the message that you want to send to those people who might come here and then have to worry about whether or not when they hit some kind of an arbitrary tax credit and grant, you know, dollar figure, do they then have to worry about the state, you know, coming in and taking what they've developed if the person who developed it decides that they want to move someplace else?
Right, and I think I think I agree with you, Brian. I mean, I think that part will not have legs in the House. People are terrified of what that means, and the whole bag of worms will open.
That's scary on a lot of levels, and what it means, what it can transfer over to, not just movies, but what other types of intellectual property are they talking about?
And there's a real question about whether or not it's even legally enforceable.
Right. Right. I was talking to an intellectual property lawyer about just the other day, and that's a question that was, you know, that was raised. So this becomes, but the issue comes down to the money issue, is that they got $7.5 million last time, and now they want $18.5 million in tax credits for House of Cards pushing it. But in a larger sense, this has been a battle going on for a while in Maryland over whether or not we want to build a film industry. I mean, there are a lot of grips and other people and cameramen I know in this town who have moved to North Carolina, Louisiana, because they can't, where there's work. Mm-hmm. But there used to be a lot of work in Maryland. It doesn't exist. There are TV network shows that are supposed to be in Baltimore that are being shot in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. Or someplace, Vancouver. Yeah.
Vancouver, someplace else. So, I mean, how deep and real is this issue for us? And what do you think are some of the issues people need to be thinking about in this? Brian?
I think one of the things that related to this, Mark, is I think there's a real question to how much how many jobs the state actually sees as a result of this. I mean, the number that's being thrown around is about $520 million or $528 million in economic benefits related to these tax credits. But look, I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, the House of Cards was shooting downtown in Baltimore. They were set up behind the Daily Record in a garage behind the Daily Record. And there was a catering truck that was in from California where everybody was getting their meals. These were not people who were going down the street to Coffeeland, which is, you know, sort of our neighborhood hangout. And they weren't going to area, they weren't going to area eateries. They were eating out of a truck that came from California and brought their lunches with them. So the question is how many jobs are Maryland jobs that actually come here, and how much of that $520 million is people who are here that are spending money? I'm not saying that $520 million is anything to sneeze at, but you do have to ask the question of how many jobs you're creating. I mean, because as the governor has said sort of repeatedly and the president has said, it's all about jobs, jobs, jobs. And, and I'm not sure that anybody's really been able to quantify how many jobs come to Maryland as a result of this.
Exactly. I mean, there's all sorts of other examples of these sort of marquee projects, whether it's rebuilding the convention center or their Hilton Hotel, things like this at the state. You can't pick winners. You should let businesses take the risk and just decide for themselves to do this. We shouldn't be in an arms race either for building a larger convention center or for providing the most tax credits. It doesn't make sense, and we're not going to win.
Right. I mean, it is competitive, and some of this is legitimate. But at the same time, I think part of the issue, we can talk about how many jobs are created, and we know there is an economic impact. But what responsibility do corporations, industries that make a ton of money in Maryland and do quite well, what is their responsibility to the state? I mean, is it to pick up and leave, and then what is the state left with? So it may be an imperfect solution to some degree, but again, there has to be something in place for states recoup something once industries leave. And again, that's something that Maryland, Baltimore in particular, has dealt with for quite some time. We do know that Baltimore is oftentimes the backdrop for D.C. places and stuff like that. But again, this is still something that has to be fleshed out. And again, there are some legitimate criticisms to the proposal.
So another question here with the minimum wage. It went through the House. The Senate president said that O'Malley's 10-10 by 217 bill would be scaled back. Let's talk about where this is. Give us the background, Brian, where we are, and then we'll come back to all of us.
Where we are is that the House passed a minimum wage bill a couple of weeks ago, and that bill sits in the Senate. It's still sitting in committee. There's a possibility that we could see some movement on it today. I've heard some rumblings in the last 24 hours that there may be some movement. I think this could literally go down to the last day of the session. I don't think that there's a lot of consensus. The chairman of the Finance Committee, Thomas Mack Middleton, has really tied the fate of the minimum wage bill to an increase for caregivers to folks who are developmental disabilities caregivers. And he's made it very clear that he wants to make sure that they get a bump. They're being paid right now at about 35% of the minimum wage, and he wants to ensure that continues. The Senate president yesterday talked about the fact that there are going to be everybody on all sides of this issue are going to be unhappy. He believes that people who want 10-10 faster, a little bit faster, are going to be disappointed. He thinks that the DDA people are going to be a little disappointed. Most people are not going to get everything they want. They're going to get a little bit. And look, you and I both know that that's generally how compromise is done in Annapolis. I still think that this probably ends up going down to, maybe Friday, possibly Monday before it's all finalized.
I'm somebody who would love to see the minimum wage increase, and it would be great if it happened tomorrow. But again, there's a compromise involved. And so from my understanding, we're looking at next year for 2015 being raised to $8.20 to $9.15 in 2016, and then getting to $10.10 in 2017. Again, it's still not exactly a living wage, but again, it affects thousands of Marylanders. And we have to think about the fact that some may argue that it has an impact on jobs and hiring, but realistically, wages have stayed stagnant. Okay, the inflation has increased. We know the cost of living has increased, so it's important that the minimum wage also increase. And it'd be great if it got to a living wage. But again, in terms of compromise, 10-10 is better than what we have right now.
Look, I don't think this is going to help the people it's aimed to help and to protect. I mean, Baltimore has one of the highest unemployment rates for young minorities, and this is just going to make it harder for them to get hired. Secondly, I mean, across the state, you're going to find that most people are being paid well above what the minimum wage is right now already. So I feel like this is more of a feel-good issue than an actual issue that's going to impact people's lives at the end of the day.
And Brian, I know you have to run to cover some sessions, so Brian Sears, Daily Record, thank you for being with us once again.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mark.
Always. Brian Sears has done some incredible reporting for the Daily Record. Just had to run to cover it. He's government reporter for the Daily Record, and it's Ion Annapolis Blog. We're still here with our two great editorial thinkers, Dr. John Bullock and Marta Mossberg. 410-319-8888 is the number here. There's also something I want to throw in here that
revenge porn. Let's talk about that.
Wow.
We did a whole show on that.
I listened to that.
It was very intense. You don't think that should pass?
I really don't, no.
You don't think that should pass?
No.
Well, I do want to get to another subject before we run out of time, but since you raised it, why do you think
it really
shouldn't
pass? Funny. I was talking about this with one of my most liberal friends, and he shocked me by saying he thought this was ridiculous. That people, why did you take the photos in the first place?
Hey,
you still have a right to display that. Again,
you gave that property to someone else,
no,
when you
didn't.
Allowed that to happen.
No, you did not do that.
And there is expectation of privacy between two people. It's not to say, well, now that I took this picture, now you can just show it everywhere.
Of course,
right?
If someone took a photo that they should not have taken, that's a separate issue from when consensual adults taking photos. Why would you do that? That's just dumb.
Some people do that.
And why? Okay, but why do you then have to deserve protection for a stupid mistake on your part? I find this just...
Because...
people are just not taking responsibility for their lives, and after they make mistakes, they're just saying the government needs to help me and protect me from making a really dumb choice, earlier down in my life.
Well, put it this way: I mean, there, you could argue that there's a moral question here, but then let's think about from a legal standpoint. Again, when someone shares something in the privacy of their own home or the privacy of a relationship, it's not the expectation that it be shown to the wide public. And again, we're in a different time period now, as opposed to 1930s, where you're taking a little snapshot. And then you have to develop it, and it's in your back room, versus you put it on the internet and it's there for millions and millions of people to see, and you can never take it away. And that can ruin someone's life. It can ruin their family. There are people who have killed themselves
behind
a lot of stuff.
So don't ever do it, even if it's in a consensual relationship. And what was it on House of Cards? The former Washington Post reporter was like, when she got fired, she said, when you fire me, you don't just give it to me. It's to 1,000 people or 100,000 people. I mean, that is what life is like. So have that expectation. But
that doesn't mean that displaying someone naked on the internet in a photo you have no right to display.
Well, why does the person not have a right to display?
It's not their property.
And it's done in a malicious fashion,
anyway,
right?
That's not, you don't have the right to put someone's image out there, no matter what it is.
Well, if they allowed you to take that photo,
people do all kinds of things in the privacy of their own sexual world. It doesn't mean that some disgusting partner you once had has a right to display that, whether it's a letter you wrote or whether it's a photograph you took.
They shouldn't do it. Sure, I'd agree with that. But legally, to spend time on this, I just feel like it's people making poor choices and not wanting to be responsible for those.
And if you're a minor, what about that?
No, that's wrong. I mean, that's point.
But
it's
all
wrong.
Well, that's covered under existing laws.
Well, we disagree on that one. I think folks should have to pay some penalty for that kind of act against another human being. But two things I want to get to here real fast, and we have like 7 or 8 minutes left. One's the Poultry Fair Share Act, which went nowhere, which was going to tax chickens per head, 5 cents or whatever that number was. And it didn't go. It was defeated. People thought it would be, but the fact that it was brought up, what I'm finding is creating a conversation that hasn't taken place before, about where the responsibility lies for the pollution in our riverways and the phosphorus in our riverways and more. Is it just with the farmers, or does it lay with the company that actually owns the chickens? That's been interesting. I think this is going to erupt some more over the course of the sessions coming up, and so you're going to see this thing pitted between Baltimore PG, Montgomery County, Eastern Shore, and there's going to be a major battle over this in the coming
years.
Well,
that was one of the big controversies with the rain tax in a lot of ways too, because you have people like
the
Frederick.
Rain tax.
yes, okay. Well, I call it the rain tax. But a lot of the pollution coming into the state is not from Maryland; it's from Delaware and Pennsylvania. And so
of it comes from our state too, though.
Right, but you're also would not be charging people based on how much pollution that they're creating. So it's a tricky one, obviously, but I think a lot of the times the state, first of all, when it taxes something for a specific cause, it often takes that money and uses it someplace else. So I have very little confidence that any tax would be actually used to clean up the bay or to stop the pollution, because it never ends up working that way.
But the point remains, it's still an externality, right? I mean, we're talking about pollution has a certain cost. It is a cost to society. It's a cost to our environment, and there's actually a financial cost in terms of cleaning it up. So someone has to take accountability for that, and whether it's the farmers and the practices, but also the businesses as well, right? So we know that many of these farmers are working for larger corporations as well that make a ton of money, and so it's important to actually have some mechanism.
And
to
very
do
quickly, I'm just curious. We're rushing this thing at the end here, but there's an amendment being kind of snuck into the budget, which is Ben Cramer's amendment. That wants to criticize, saying, it looks like basically saying you criticize Israel, you're being anti-Semitic.
Wasn't there something like the American Humanities Association or something along?
American Studies Association.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And saying that Israel is the only democracy and we support them. And I mean, and first of all, A, why is Maryland doing this? What's it got to do with state policy? Mm-hmm. And B, it's like it's being snuck into
the budget
bill. So it will pass, and nobody will look like they've voted for things. Even people like Delegate Mary Washington backed away from the bill. You know, the other people backed away because it doesn't take into account Palestinians or occupied territories or whatever else. Mm-hmm. Just condemning people who support Democratic have the Democratic right to support the idea of a boycott, whether you agree with it or not.
Well, this is like a classic political move. I mean, look at congressional bills. I mean, they deal with about 1,500 different topics in one bill. It makes absolutely no sense. I wish that bills were a single issue bill so that you couldn't do things like this and everything was debated on its own versus shoved in at the end.
Right. I mean, there's no real reason to shove it in other than for political reasons. But realistically, because an organization or any organization, decides to boycott, based upon, political practice, again, is their prerogative. And again, we can agree and we can disagree. But if we look at the rights of Palestinians, they should have rights just as equal to the state of Israel. And so sometimes people from a distance are really trying to make political gestures. But again, they're not looking at the entire picture.
Well, it's been great to have you all here. Dr. John Bullock, professor of political science at Towson University and MARTA Mossberg, visiting fellow with the Maryland Public Policy Institute, national syndicated columnist, and earlier joining us for the hour was Brian Sears from the Daily Record and Charles Robinson from Maryland Public Television.
It was a lot of fun, Mark. Thanks.
It was. Great
Thanks
to have you all
great
with us.
Great to be here.
Always great to have you two here, so thank you so much. We're going to take a very brief break, going out with more Marvin Gaye, his birthday today. Well, that rhymed. Mm-hmm. And we'll be back to talk about some really interesting things that are not on the radar for a lot of people, but we'll be wrestling with him and talking about them. A man we lost today who was the godfather of house music. Stay with us.